Now, this sermon is different. I'm glad you're here, and I hope that I can get some comments and questions about it. Let's all stand on the scriptures. It's Matthew 13, verse 29 and 30, where it says, "But he said, Nay, lest while you gather up the tares, you root up also the wheat with them. Let both grow together until the harvest. And in the time of the harvest, I will say to the reapers, Gather ye together first the tares, and bind them in bundles to burn them, but gather the wheat into my barn." You may be seated. This sermon is the Holy Seed, part 30, the Divine Right of Kings. I hope you learned something from this sermon. I certainly did. I didn't know a lot of this sermon. There are two competing grains in these two verses, the tares and the wheat. One is evil, the other is good. The instructions given to the gatherers is to gather the tares first. Bind them in bundles and burn them, but the wheat gather them into my barn. But they had to wait until the proper time, the harvest. Why? So the reapers could tell them apart. Notice the tares are to be taken first. Joshua 23, verse 13 says, "Know for a certainty that Yahweh your God will no more drive out any of these nations," referring to the seven mighty nations of the Canaanites, "from before you. But they shall be snares and traps unto you, and scourges in your sides, and thorns in your eyes, until you perish from off this good land which Yahweh your God has given you." Thorns in the eyes is, oh my goodness, so painful. This was God's warning to the Israelites that through his general Joshua, that if they let the Canaanites remain in the land of Palestine, that they would no longer be driven out from before them. They'd be snares, traps, scourges, and thorns to the Israelites. The enemy would provide the harm that would result from Israel's disobedience to keep them living in the land that they were promised. Australian bushfires. The world is going insane. No, it is already insane. There are two basic sides to almost every question. Take the forest fires in Australia. One side blames it on the climate change. The other side denies that this is the cause. They blame it on the climate change agents themselves. But did climate change cause these forest fires? Oh, what caused these forest fires are three decades of government failure to stand up to the environment terrorists. It is these environmental greenies that caused the forest fires. Three decades of these same greenies that bound the government to stop backburning in the state forest. The same greenies that petitioned the weak government to ban cattle grazing in state forest and high alpine pastures. Reminds me of what President Trump said about the wildfires in the state of California. He was going to withhold money to the state until they fixed the problem that caused the forest fires in the first place. Are the tares and wheat distinguishable here? The Senate hearing on the impeachment. At the Senate hearing on the impeachment of President Trump, Mitch McConnell said that Representative Chuck Schumer ran for office, saying that he would vote to acquit President Clinton on his upcoming impeachment trial. This was before the trial even started. McConnell said, "What kind of person is this, that he had his mind made up before he heard all the evidence?" In fact, before he heard any of the evidence. should he be giving the Senate advice today on what is a fair trial? Was that the actions of a tare or a wheat? The Biden crime family. Here's a summation of the Tea Party's recent email about Hunter Biden's terrible escapades in the last few years. Now, if a regular person was running for president and their son was caught up in, number one, drug abuse, number two, continuous paternity cases, number three, identity theft accusations, and four, having been paid by a lucrative foreign firm during the time his father had served in office with having any experience, they'd be ending their campaign in disgrace. But this is an Obama alum we're talking about. The media won't touch him. The English Civil War. Who cares about the Civil War that was fought in England? I do. Because if the monarchy was abolished, then what about the words of Yahweh our God? Was he in error when he made the following? Jeremiah 33, verse 17 says, "For thus saith Yahweh." But what does he say? "David shall never want a man to sit upon the throne of the house of Israel." So we're left with a choice. Either, number one, the Lord put his promise of the eternal throne of David on hold for 600 years, before fulfilling his promise to David in Jesus, who never actually took the throne at this time, and then again putting the promise on hold for at least another 2,000 years before the return of Jesus, at which time he will somehow claim a throne that nobody remembers and has not existed anywhere since King Zedekiah's time. Or Yahweh has remained true to his promise and has actively watched over the throne of David throughout his story, keeping it ready for the return of Christ, who will claim his rightful throne and rule over Israel once again. England's first civil war. What about the English king's fight with the Parliament? The second Stuart king, King Charles I, had a lot of difficulty with the Parliament. Charles I was the king of Scotland, Ireland, and England. After a failed attempt to marry him to the Spanish Habsburg princess Marina Anna, he married the Catholic Bourbon princess Henrietta Maria of France. Why did the marriage between Marie Anna and Charles I fail to take place? Marie Anna wanted to marry only a converted Catholic, and Charles I refused to convert to Catholicism. Who did Marie Anna then marry? Ferdinand III, Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, King of Hungary and Bohemia. So Marie Anna became Queen of Hungary and Bohemia. This eventually played a part in the start of World War I. But I'll talk about that later. Charles I believed in the divine right of kings and was determined to govern according to his own conscience. You probably studied that in seventh grade. He believed that only God could judge whether his policies were good or bad. He didn't need a parliament to tell him what was right or wrong. He was free of any man's criticism. But many of his subjects opposed his policies. For example, the levying of taxes without parliamentary consent, and perceived his actions as those of a tyrannical, absolute monarch. Charles I's religious policies, coupled with his marriage to a Roman Catholic, generated the mistrust of English Puritans and the Scottish Covenanters, who thought his views were too Catholic. His attempts to force the Church of Scotland to adopt high Anglican practices led to the Bishops' War and strengthened the position of the English and Scottish parliaments. Charles I fought the armies of the English and Scottish parliaments, mainly Puritans and Presbyterians, in the English Civil War. After he was defeated in 1645, he surrendered to a Scottish force that eventually handed him over to the English Parliament. Charles I refused to accept his captives' demands of a constitutional monarchy and temporarily escaped captivity in November 1647. Re-imprisoned on the Isle of Wight, Charles I forged an alliance with Scotland, and by the end of 1648, Oliver Cromwell's new model army had consolidated its control over England. Charles I was tried, convicted, and executed for high treason in January 1649. The monarchy was abolished. And the Commonwealth of England was established as a republic. England was no longer a monarchy. It was a republic run by the Protestant Parliament. I've got a question. What side would you have been on if you had been alive at this time? The royalty or the parliament or neither? What side should a Christian be on? The mostly Catholic royalty or the mostly Protestant parliament? Oliver Cromwell was a Calvinist, but he allowed the Jews to return to England after 360 years. All the Stuart kings, James I, Charles I, Charles II, and James II, were in favor of the divine right of kings, but they were more Catholic than Protestant. But the Parliament was more Protestant than Catholic. But they allowed the Jews to return. Which side would you be on? Which side exhibited the fruit of the Spirit or the works of the flesh? Galatians chapter 5, verse 19 through 26. Now the works of the flesh are manifest, which are these: adultery, fornication, uncleanness, lasciviousness, idolatry, witchcraft, hatred, variance, emulations, wrath, strife, seditions, heresies, envyings, murders, drunkenness, revilings, and such like, of which I told you before, as I also told you in time past, that they which do such things shall not inherit the kingdom of God. But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, faith, meekness, temperance. Against such there is no law. Who was Christian in the action that took place in England during the Civil War? Now, Charles II beheaded Algernon Sidney in 1683 for being against the divine right of kings. Did Charles II act according to the works of the flesh or the works of the Spirit? Did Algernon Sidney act according to the works of the flesh or the works of the Spirit? James II, Charles II's brother, was the last English king who operated under the divine right of kings. After his reign, King William and Queen Mary initiated a Bill of Rights which limited the monarch's power. More about this later. And now we get the map. This is the map. It's titled The British Isles. England, Britain. Are those two words interchangeable? No. England is located here. What's this over here? Wales. What's this here? You put all these together, you get Britain, or the United Kingdom. This is Southern Ireland. What's this little thing here? Isle of Man. Equal distance from all three. What's it over here? The three-legged. It's the Isle of Man. What's this down here? The Isle of Wight, where Charles I went. So this is the British Isles. This is England. Parliament's new model army. England was no longer a monarchy. Parliament had defeated the king. But what about the descendants of David ruling over the house of Israel? There was no longer any descendant ruling over the house of Israel in the British Isles. Question. Did our Lord God approve of the Protestant Parliament, or did he approve of the Catholic royalty? What was the Lord God's view in this time of English history? One of the reasons for Parliament's victory was Oliver Cromwell and his new model army. What's that all about? The parliamentarians had a new model army. For the first time, lower caste people could become officers in the parliamentary army, being promoted for their skill of leadership and not limited to the leaders of the nation. The new army contained a larger number of ideologically committed soldiers and officers than any other army that had taken the field. In the past, people became officers because they came from powerful and wealthy families. In the new model army, men were promoted when they showed themselves to be good soldiers. For the first time, it became possible for working class men to become army officers. Oliver Cromwell thought it was very important that soldiers believed strongly in what they were fighting for. Where possible, he recruited men who, like him, had strong Puritan views, and the new model army went into battle singing psalms, convinced that God was on their side. England, 100 or so years before the Constitution of the United States was written, had tried to get rid of its monarchy and succeeded. They didn't have a king or queen for 11 years. They had only a parliament in the beginning. But things didn't go any better. In fact, they became worse. Number one, they continued their war with Ireland. And number two, they let the Jews, who had been banned for over 360 years, back into their country. The leaders of Parliament, including Oliver Cromwell, accepted usury loans from the Jews who were living in Amsterdam, Holland. Oliver also let the rabbi Ben Israel's book, The Hope of Israel, to be sent to the clergy, which promoted the British Israel doctrine, which led to the phrase Judeo-Christian theology in the world today. The Second Civil War. Soon after the First Civil War, there was another civil war in England. This time, it was the Catholic Confederation of Ireland who joined with the English royalists fighting against the parliamentary forces. In the War of Ireland from 1649 to 1653, the Irish Catholic Confederation allied with the English royalists who had been defeated by the Protestant parliamentarians in the English Civil War. By May 1652, Oliver Cromwell's parliamentary army soundly defeated the Confederation and Royalist coalition in Ireland and occupied the country, ending the Irish Confederation Wars. For another year, guerrilla warfare continued. Now, what do you think Cromwell did? He defeated Ireland. How did he treat them? Cromwell passed a series of penal laws against Roman Catholics, which was most of the population, and confiscated large amounts of their land. The majority of Roman Catholics who owned land had it taken away from them. Are you descended from the Irish Catholics or from the English royalists or from the Protestant parliamentarians? My grandmother, my mother's mother, married an Irish Catholic whose family had come from Ireland. My grandmother, who was a Southern Baptist, refused to marry my grandfather unless he left the Catholic Church. He did, and his family disowned him. I wonder if his family had their land taken away from them by Oliver Cromwell. Or maybe they were sold as slaves. The Irish were slaves. No wonder most Catholics hate Oliver Cromwell. Maybe a few of you are descended from all three. But many of you are descended from at least one of these groups in history. This war was as bad for the Irish as the South experienced in our war between the states. If you are Irish in ancestry, did Oliver Cromwell take the land from your ancestors and or send them to another land as slaves, or did he have them killed? But before we talk about what happened to the defeated Irish, we want to talk about why the English Parliament, victorious in the English Civil War, had several reasons for sending an army to Ireland in 1649. Number one, an alliance was signed in 1649 between the Irish Confederate Catholics, Charles II, who was the exiled son of the executed Charles I, and the English Royalists. So the English Royalists got beat by the Parliament. They joined up with the Catholic Confederation of Ireland. So those two are going to fight the Parliament in the Second War. This allowed for Royalist troops to be sent to Ireland and put the Irish Confederate Catholic troops under the command of Royalist officers. Their aim was to invade England and restore the monarchy there. Well, this was a threat which the new English Commonwealth could not afford to ignore. Even if the Confederates, number two, had not allied themselves with the Royalists, it's likely that the English Parliament would have eventually tried to reconquer Ireland. They had sent parliamentary forces to Ireland throughout the Wars of the Three Kingdoms. England, Scotland, and Ireland. They viewed Ireland as a part of the territory governed by right by the Kingdom of England, and only temporary out of control since the Irish Rebellion of 1641. Number three. In addition, many parliamentarians wished to punish the Irish for atrocities against English Protestant settlers during the 1641 uprising. Four, some Irish towns, namely Wexford and Waterford Crystal, had acted as bases from which privateers had attacked English shipping during the 1640s. And number five, Parliament had raised loans of £10 million under the Adventurers Act to subdue Ireland since 1640, get this, on the basis that its creditors would be repaid with land confiscated from the Irish Catholic rebels. All the loans always caused a problem. To repay these creditors, it would be necessary to conquer Ireland and confiscate such land. Who were the creditors that had to be repaid from the loans that they were given to the Parliament? It was the Jews from Holland who had put the money and would be repaid with the land seized from Ireland. The War of 1641 to 1653 in Ireland produced the greatest population loss in Irish history, with the exception of the Great Famine of the 1840s. The Parliamentarian reconquest of Ireland was brutal. But that isn't surprising when you consider the Cromwell's Republican Revolution was financed by the Jewish bankers from Amsterdam. Jews hate the Catholic Church and traditional Christian institutions like the monarchy, unless royals grovel before Jews, as Prince Charles does today. See my last sermon. Why do Jews hate the monarchy? Because Yahweh, God of Israel, commanded the monarchy would be the form of government for his people after they asked that he abdicate off the throne. James II was the last king or queen of the British Isles that ruled under the divine right of kings. The monarchy since that time has been limited by the Parliament. Under the leadership of Oliver Cromwell in 1649, Charles I was tried for high treason, convicted, and executed. This marked the conclusion of the English Civil War, resulting in the Parliament of England overthrowing the English monarchy, initiating a period of the English Republic. The 17th century was the dawn of widespread use of printing presses and changes for improved communication. After 11 years in 1660, a limited monarchy was restored and moderated by an independent parliament. Now I'm going to talk about our country. Organized anti-Americanism is what is now the United States, developed out of a gradual revolution that began in 1765 as colonists resisted a stamp tax through boycott and condemnation of tax officials. While they were subject to the Parliament of the United Kingdom authority, as the monarchy became a limited monarchy since 1688, the North American citizens enjoyed a level of autonomy that increasingly clashed with Parliament that did not provide seats for parliamentary representatives. With the Declaration of Independence in 1776, anti-monarchical propaganda resulted in violent protests that systematically removed symbols of monarchy. Parliamentary loyalists were particularly affected by partisan attacks, with tens of thousands leaving for Canada. Property that remained was confiscated by each of the 13 newly created states through newly passed laws. Artifacts from the colonial period depicting the British monarchy are seldom found in the United States. However, not all sentiment equated to anti-monarchism. a normality of a monarchy at the head of a polity remained, that some Americans saw a presidency in monarchical terms, a Caesar of the Republic, was an early debate of the new republic. Well, let's go back and talk about the impact of the war on the Irish population. It was unquestionably severe. The war resulted in famine, which was worsened by the outbreak of the bubonic plague. The parliamentarians also transported about 50,000 people as indentured laborers. Hey, Ireland's not a big country. Where did these 50,000 Irish Catholics and English royalists go? Many of the English royalists went to the English settlement of Virginia, and most of the Catholics went to the English Caribbean island of Barbados. Is that right? Barbados? What?
Barbados.
Barbados. Irish Catholic boys and girls were shipped to Barbados and sold to the planters as slaves. Many of the plantation owners were Jews from Holland. Should the Irish seek reparations from the English and Jews? As a side note, this is a little side note. I thought this was a little humorous. The youths that were sent to Barbados to work in sugar plantations wore short pants. Their legs were burnt, since Barbados is near the equator. Their legs didn't turn black, as many of the Universalist pastors will tell us, but they turned red. Thus, they were called the Red Legs. Well, that's the same name as the professional baseball team in Cincinnati is called, because the baseball team wore red stockings. The Irish slaves were called Red Legs because that is what they had. Their legs had been burnt red from exposure to the sun while they were slaves in the sugar plantations. Now, where's Barbados? You find it? Barbados. There's Venezuela. Barbados is south of Puerto Rico. So about 50,000 boys and girls, Irish boys and girls, went to Barbados. Well, that was a British island. And they were slaves. Whatever happened to them? Well, some of them came to the United States. But let's review what Oliver Cromwell had done. Number one, in the 1650s, against public outcry, he opened England's gates to Jewish international bankers. England's gates. Remember what Pastor Blanchard said. He opened English gates to Jewish international bankers, thereby infecting England with usury for the first time in 400 years. Cromwell killed thousands of unarmed Catholics who surrendered to his army. They surrendered. Killed them. Cromwell's army looted cities, killed his opponents and their wives and their children. Ships were loaded with thousands of his captives to be sold into slavery in Barbados. Now, do you think that Oliver Cromwell was a quote-unquote good Christian? Do you think that he was a Christian? The King of England, Scotland, Wales, Ireland, the colony of Virginia, and the islands of Barbados and Bermuda. Have you ever thought who the other countries, colonies, and islands had their allegiance with when the several civil wars happened in England. The first civil war, Charles I, had his problems with Parliament. Charles was an unconverted Catholic for most of his life, and Parliament was Protestant. Scotland and England were defeated by Oliver Cromwell and the Parliament. Ireland was mostly Catholic and was in favor of the defeated Charles I. Virginia was also on the side of the defeated party, as well as the island of Barbados. Remember, there were no cell phones available where a person could take a picture or send an email to anywhere in the world in a moment's notice. Virginia didn't hear of the beheading of their English king until news got there by boat. The Commonwealth. Parliament now passed a series of new laws. Number one, they abolished the monarchy on the grounds that it was, quote, unnecessary, burdensome, and dangerous to the liberty, safety, and public interest of the people, unquote. And the House of Lords as, quote, it is useless and dangerous to the people of England, unquote. Well, that's what they wanted. That's what they got. They ignored the Holy Scriptures that told of their ancestors demanding that God abdicate the throne of Israel and that they be given a king like all the other nations had. Number two, lands owned by the royal family and the church, that's the Catholic Church, were sold and the money was used to pay the parliamentary soldiers. Three, people were no longer fined for not attending their local church. You got fined for not attending the church. However, everyone was still expected to attend some form of religious worship on Sundays. And four, the country was now declared to be, quote, a commonwealth and free state, unquote, under the rule of Parliament, and the government was entrusted to a council of state under provisional chairmanship of Oliver Cromwell. Cromwell sent about a dozen ships to blockade Virginia and put pressure on the colony to support the Parliament. It was a terrible time in England. The Protestants sent a few ships to Barbados, and they quickly submitted to the rule of the Parliament. But Virginia was much more stubborn. The Pilgrims sent to Virginia soon left and went to the northeast of the country. The development of the plantation economy and African slavery in Carolina began before English colonists even settled Charlestown, named after King Charles II in 1670. Carolina was only one colony until 1729. There was no north or south. Carolina was named to honor Charles IX of France, and then Charles I, and Charles II of England. In 1663, eight Lord Protectors in England received land grants in North America from King Charles II for their loyalty to the monarchy during the English Civil War. So they divide up the Carolinas. Eight loyal subjects to King Charles II. The eight lords decided to combine their shares to establish a profit-seeking propriety settlement, Carolina, between the English colony of Virginia and Spanish Florida. To ensure financial success, they sent representatives to stay the lucrative sugar plantation on the Caribbean island of Barbados. They also recruited white settlers from this English West Indian colony, Barbados, to help launch their new North American settlement. They come from Barbados to Carolina. These white Barbadians often brought enslaved Africans and African Barbadians with them. Sugarcane never became a major cash crop in Carolina, but these Barbadians eventually transplanted their West Indian model of plantations and slavery to the new colony. Initially, low county planters attempted and failed to develop a cash crop from olives, grapes, mulberry trees, and different English-based grains. Carolina settlers also engaged in the fur trade with American Indians, extracted tar and pitch for naval stores, and raised livestock for exporting packed beef to the English West Indies. By 1690, however, Lowcountry planters had successfully applied the West Indian plantation model to rice, and Carolina rapidly developed into a lucrative plantation economy and slave society. The history of Jews in Charleston, South Carolina, was related to the 1669 charter of the Carolina Colony, drawn up by the first Earl of Salisbury and his secretary, blank, blank. Who was the secretary? Who was the secretary who wrote the charter for Charleston? Nope. You'll see later. And this charter, which granted liberty of conscience to all settlers and expressly noted, quote, Jews, heathens, and dissenters, unquote, Sephardic Jews from London were among the early settlers in the city and colony and comprised most of its Jewish community in the early 1800s. In 1800, South Carolina had the largest Jewish population of any state of the United States. Did you know that? By 1800, there were about 2,000 Jews in South Carolina, overwhelmingly Sephardic, and settled in Charlestown, which was more than in any other United States state at that time, and more than any other town, city, or place in North America. Charleston remained the unofficial capital of North American Jewry until about 1830. When the increasing number of Ashkenazi German Jews emigrated to America, settled largely in New Orleans, Richmond, Savannah, Baltimore, and the Northeast, particularly in Boston, New York City, and Philadelphia. Their numbers, added to by the later immigration of Ashkenazi Jews from Eastern Europe to the Northeast and Midwest industrial cities, far surpassed the mostly Sephardic Jewish community in Charleston. Now, Charlestown, with an E on the end, which was shortened to Charlestown, then Charleston, was the headquarters of Sephardic Jew in North America. The town was named after Charles II, the man who restored the monarchy in England. Was this the town that the Freemasons had their main headquarters? Was this the town where the war between the states began? And who was the secretary that drew up the charter that granted liberty of conscience to all settlers and expressly noted, quote, Jews, heathens, and dissenters, unquote, could live there? The man who allowed the Antichrist to live in the land of the children of God, it was John Locke. And who had Charles II beheaded? It was Algernon Sidney in 1683 for being against the divine right of kings. Who was John Locke and Algernon Sidney? My conclusion. Algernon Sidney's influence on political thought in 18th century Britain and colonial America was probably second only to that of John Locke among 17th century political theorists. Oh, John Locke and Sidney, Locke and Sidney, were the two most important men in U.S. history. Or did you pass the seventh grade test? In his study of political theory in Britain from 1689 to 1720, J.P. Kenyon said that Sidney's discourses, quote, were certainly much more influential than Locke's two treaties, unquote. Now, the Hampton-Sidney College is named after two men who were leaders in the English Civil War. The college is in Hampton, Sidney, Virginia. John Hampton, 1594 to 1643, was one of the leading parliamentarians involved in challenging the authority of King Charles I and became a national figure when he stood trial in 1637 for his refusal to be taxed for ship money. He was one of the five members who attempted whose attempted unconstitutional arrest by King Charles I in the House of Commons in 1642 actually sparked the English Civil War. And the other man is Sidney, the man who Charles II beheaded for refusing to acknowledge the divine right of kings. John Locke and Algernon Sidney, the two men whose philosophy led to our present democratic republic, unquote. The men who ignored what the scripture warned us about. Don't let the Antichrist live in your land. If you do, you will worship their gods and not serve me. Here's a picture of Algernon Sidney. Anybody know anything about that? They put the hand in there. I'd say he's amazing. I had American history in the 4th, 7th, and 11th grade in school. That's the way it was. 4th grade, 7th grade, 11th grade. We were told that the founders, George Washington, James Madison, James Mason, Thomas Jefferson, James Monroe, Benjamin Franklin, read John Locke and other English philosophers like Algernon Sidney. They gleaned that they had read and come up with the principles of rulership of the people. England, 100 or so years before the Constitution of the United States was written, had tried to get rid of its monarchy and succeeded. They didn't have a king or queen for 11 years. They had a parliament. They continued their war with Ireland and let the Jews who had been banned for over 360 years back into the country. Their leaders of parliament, Oliver Cromwell, accepted loans from the Jews who were living in Amsterdam, Holland, and he let Rabbi Ben Israel's book, The Hope of Israel, to be sent to the clergy, which promoted the British Israel doctrine, which led to the phrase Judeo-Christian theology in the world today. American founders read all about the possible governments in the world, past and present, but the majority ignored the Bible. Most historians say the two most followed writers were John Locke and Algernon Sidney. The works of Algernon Sidney, along with those of contemporary John Locke, are considered a cornerstone of Western thought. Discourses concerning government which cost Sidney his head. However, the ideas it put forth survived and ultimately culminated in the founding of the United States. Sidney directly opposed the divine right of kings, political theory, by suggesting ideals such as limited government, voluntary consent of the people, and the right of citizens to alter or abolish a corrupt government. Sidney's discourses concerning government, along with Locke's two treaties on government, are recognized as critical works in the founding of the United States of America. The founding fathers read and studied these works during their years as students in the early colonial universities. Thomas Jefferson, in particular, is known to have heavily studied and researched the works of Locke and Sidney. The discourses concerning government has been called the, quote, textbook of the American Revolution, unquote. Got a question. Do you believe that America took the right turn? To be continued, blessed be the Lord God of Israel.